Good evening. Violence explodes in the streets as Haitians protest corruption. The L train tunnel will be ready ahead of schedule and the double standard for whistleblowers. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Urienzo with the news for Tuesday, October 1st, 2019. A journalist was wounded by gunfire in Haiti as police fired live ammunition to disperse protesters on Monday. The protests occurred amid mounting anger over an escalating economic and political crisis. It was the second time in a week that a journalist was shot by Haitian authorities. At least four people have been shot and killed in recent days. A Haitian senator opened fire during a protest outside the country's parliament building, wounding two people, including a photographer. Crippling fuel shortages have triggered weeks of anti-government protests, plunging the country into an economic and political crisis. Soaring inflation and allegations of government corruption have compounded Haiti's woes, leading to calls for Jovenel Moïse, president since 2017, to resign. Earlier this year, Moïse refused calls to leave, saying he would not leave the country in the hands of what he called armed gangs and drug traffickers. And a white former Dallas police officer who shot her black unarmed neighbor to death after she said mistaking his apartment for her own was convicted of murder Tuesday.
The jury having reached a verdict, Ms. Geiger and your team, would you please stand? We, the jury, unanimously find the defendant, Amber Geiger, guilty of murder as charged in the indictment. No outburst. And it is signed by the presiding juror, who is juror number 11. Mr. Rogers, would you like to have the jury poll?
The verdict prompted tears of relief from the family and chants of Black Lives Matter from a crowd outside the courtroom. The jury took a matter of hours to convict Geiger, 31, her name is Amber Geiger, after 6 days of testimony. The same jury that found her guilty in the September 2018 death of her upstairs neighbor, Botham Jean, will consider her fate after hearing additional testimony starting this afternoon. She could be sentenced to from 5 to 99 years in prison under Texas law. The basic facts of the unusual shooting were not in dispute throughout the trial. After a long shift at work and still in uniform, Geiger walked up to Jean's apartment, which was on the fourth floor, directly above hers on the third, and found the door unlocked. Thinking the apartment was her own, she drew her service weapon and entered. Geiger testified to what happened next.
I feel like a terrible person. I feel like a piece of crap. I hate that I have to live with this every single day of my life. I never wanted to take an innocent person's life. And I am so sorry. This is not about hate. It's about being scared that night.
But me putting that key, the key fob into the lock, is pushing the door open. And everything's happening all at once. I used my left arm to fully open it. And at that time, that's whenever I'm drawing my service weapon out. I pulled my gun out and I yelled at him. It's like, let me see your hands. Let me see your hands. Yes.
When you pulled that trigger, you intended to kill Mr. John.
He was the threat. Yes, sir. I tried to do a little CPR.
While activists and observers welcomed the rare conviction of a police officer in a case where the victim was black, most cautioned that the outcome was not the result of changing attitudes, but of a rare set of circumstances, an unarmed black man killed in his apartment by an off-duty white officer who said she mistakenly believed she was in her own home. Geiger could be sentenced, as I said earlier, to from 5 to 99 years in prison under Texas law. And former Representative Chris Collins pleaded guilty to two counts of insider trading Tuesday, a day after he resigned from Congress and set off a scramble to fill his seat in the deep red Republican district outside of Buffalo. Collins had initially denied charges he leaked confidential information about a pharmaceutical company to his son. But on Monday, the Republican from Western New York withdrew his not guilty plea and resigned from Congress. He faces up to 5 years in prison on each count. His son Cameron is expected to plead guilty Thursday. Jeffrey Berman is United States Attorney for the Southern District of New York. He had this to say.
Good afternoon. I'm Jeff Berman, United States Attorney for the Southern District of New York. Moments ago, former New York Congressman Christopher Collins pled guilty to insider trading and to lying to the FBI in order to cover up his insider trading scheme. Collins admitted to, among other things, illegally tipping his son while standing on the White House lawn. By virtue of his position, Collins helped write the laws of this country, yet acted as if the law didn't apply to him. This courthouse is a representation, personifies the ideal of equal justice under law. No one is above the law, and it is because of our office's commitment to and pursuit of that ideal that Collins is now a convicted felon and no longer a member of Congress.
Jeffrey Berman is United States Attorney for the Southern District of New York. Collins was the first major Republican to support Donald Trump in 2016. And you're listening to the news on WBAI Pacifica Radio in New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. In local news, the L train slowdown that's bedeviled New York commuters for months will be ending in April, 3 months ahead of schedule and on budget, according to Governor Andrew Cuomo. Cuomo echoed community complaints that major construction projects in New York City often take much longer to complete than advertised.
Call me a cynic, but if the MTA estimated 15 or 18 months, you know, maybe 2 years, you close down the L train tunnel, roughly 300,000 people would be inconvenienced. You know what 300,000 people is? It's larger than the entire population of the city of Buffalo. It's larger than the population of the city of Newark. You can't just say to 300,000 people, oh, find another way to commute. So the challenge was rebuild a better tunnel and do it faster. The original ambitious goal was the MTA had said 15 to 18 months total shutdown. We will rehab it in 15 to 18 months with only weekends and nights as an outage, which was a major shift from total shutdown to just weekends and nights, and you'd have continued service. We have now exceeded that ambitious goal. And thanks to the good work of Jano and Mark Roche and Sean Kildare, the new ambitious goal is to have everything done and finished and the L train fully operational, not in 15 to 18 months, but in 12 months. And we are already ahead of schedule by the current plan. If they keep working 7 days a week and depriving their family of their presence and comfort, we'll get it done by April. That will be 12 months in totality without any shutdown from an original design of 15 to 18 months total shutdown.
The L trains pass through the Canarsie Tunnel, which was damaged by flooding from Hurricane Sandy in 2012. The original project would have ripped out the concrete bench walls and replaced cables used for the tunnel signaling system. It would have required a total shutdown of the heavily used L train. Cuomo stepped into the fray last year and had an independent team of experts look at the project. The experts came up with a new plan to hang the cables from clamps. Some have criticized the new method as temporary, but the governor maintains the new cables will last 100 years.
The original design put the cables in the middle of the cement bench wall. Why? Because they needed to protect it in case of fire, and the only way they could protect the cable was by putting it in cement. But now you have coatings and coverings of the cables that are fire resistant, and you don't have to bury it in cement, which means you have access to it, you want to change it, you want to upgrade it, it's right here. The fiber optic monitoring system, how smart. Run a fiber optic through the whole tunnel. God forbid there's a tremor that maybe could impact the structural integrity of the tunnel, you'll know. It can detect water, can detect temperature changes. It's just a safer tunnel than ever before. So it is a better design.
And Cuomo added that his administration has been responsible for innovations in major projects across the city.
Bring that innovation back. And that's what we're doing across the state. This project was impossible. I have news for you. The Kosciuszko Bridge was impossible. The Mario Cuomo Bridge was impossible. LaGuardia Airport, building a new airport while you're operating the old airport, that's impossible. Everybody knows that. The third track on the Long Island Railroad, that's impossible. No, nothing is impossible in New York. That's why New York is New York.
Cuomo's decision to bring in independent experts energized community groups across the city to request similar outside input. In Brooklyn Heights, residents want an independent review of a major plan to reconstruct the Brooklyn Queens Expressway underneath the Brooklyn Heights Promenade. On the Lower East Side, residents are demanding a similar independent review of plans to close East River Park and lift it by 8 feet. Some park activists say the city's promise to complete that project in under 4 years was a similar pipe dream. And back to impeachment news. The Trump administration and the leaders of the House impeachment inquiry clashed Tuesday over Democrats' demands to depose State Department officials who are witnesses in their growing investigation. Both sides accused each other of underhanded tactics. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo pushed back, saying the effort amounted to an act of intimidation and did not allow enough time for the State Department to properly respond. The chairman of the House Intelligence, Foreign Affairs, and Oversight and Reform Committees, who have scheduled the confidential interviews, scoffed at the suggestion, saying Pompeo was the intimidator. House Intelligence Chair Adam Schiff reminded Pompeo not cooperating with Congress could be a crime. Pompeo didn't outright refuse to allow the State Department employees to answer House investigators' questions about the actions of Trump and his personal lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani. The questions are at the heart of the whistleblower's complaint, detailing attempts by Trump to pressure Ukraine's leaders to help smear former Vice President Joseph Biden, using Giuliani as spearhead. Trump, in an angry round of Twitter posts, suggested that Schiff, Democrat of California, should be arrested. But Trump saved most of his apparent bile for the whistleblower, demanding he should be allowed to interview the person. The identity of the whistleblower has remained a secret. Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa, the senior-most Senate Republican and a longtime champion of whistleblower laws, responded forcefully, saying the government and the news media should always work to respect whistleblowers' requests for confidentiality. He did not explicitly mention Trump. With all the demands to protect or reveal the whistleblower's identity and calls for respecting their privacy, commentator Norman Solomon, executive director of the Institute for Public Policy, says political leaders have forgotten whistleblowers like Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden, who have been either jailed or forced into exile. Solomon says it's a double standard.
Just as we need overall a single standard of human rights, we need a single standard of support for whistleblowers, and that includes so-called national security whistleblowers. So, for instance, when Edward Snowden surfaced in Hong Kong and provided his tremendous public service to expose the shredding of the Fourth Amendment with mass surveillance by the U.S. National Security Agency, we had, for instance, then Secretary of State John Kerry working for the Obama administration publicly proclaiming that Snowden was, quote, a traitor, unquote. Well, this tells you a lot about the Democratic Party establishment view of whistleblowing when it goes up against the military-industrial intelligence complex. Very recently now, with this uproar about the now unidentified whistleblower who exposed the very improper phone call that Trump had with Ukraine's president, we've had, I think, quite appropriate praise of that whistleblowing, but we have the online action group Move On, which claims an email list of 8 million people, expressing support for that whistleblower and actually joining with an organization that is helping to defend that whistleblower, which is quite good, except that organization actually opposes the rights of people like Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning and Jeffrey Sterling and other national security whistleblowers. You've got this ostensibly progressive organization, MoveOn.org, supporting a position that says if a whistleblower goes outside of the official channels and actually provides information to journalists, then that's not really whistleblowing and does not deserve legal protection. That's outrageous and really cuts against the basic concept of whistleblowing for the informed consent of the governed. It's a position that would say, for instance, Daniel Ellsberg, the Pentagon Papers whistleblower, therefore would have no right to a legal defense and would have no rights as a whistleblower. So this is a contradiction that exists right now. It's better to put it out in the open, because otherwise we're going to have essentially de facto two categories of whistleblowers, the good ones and the so-called bad ones, the ones that will be praised because they work within channels and they don't go to the press and they are in sync with the Democratic Party positions, and we'll have the ones who are tarred and denigrated and often prosecuted and thrown in prison.
We are seeing this separation out of two types of whistleblower. What is the difference? What is making the difference right now?
The basic difference is whether the whistleblower, as a so-called national security one, challenges the establishment that is waging endless war, that is profiteering with billions of dollars in Pentagon and Intel contracts, and that is part of the war machinery, the surveillance machinery, and the overall process by which the U.S. government operates 800 overseas military bases and does enormous damage to civil liberties with routine mass surveillance and so forth. So you've got some very courageous whistleblowers who have been willing and able, through working in the military or NSA or CIA, they've been willing and able to provide that information to journalists. And those are the folks who are, I believe, very much in need of support, but get very little from the mass media, and as I mentioned, don't even get support from a group like Move On.
What's wrong with the whistleblowing laws and protections that we have? Is there anything broken that could be fixed?
There's virtually no protections in federal law for whistleblowers in the so-called national security area. So, for instance, Daniel Ellsberg, when he was put on trial for leaking the Pentagon Papers, the judge did not allow him to testify as to why he provided the public through media with the Pentagon Papers, the reasons why he did it. That's true under the Espionage Act, which is now 100 years old, that's been used against national security whistleblowers. It's true of that law and the way it's being applied. Ultimately, yes, it is a problem with laws. It's ultimately a political problem, because as long as you have basically a bipartisan view that will praise certain whistleblowers in certain circumscribed contexts if it suits narrow partisan interests, but condemns whistleblowers who really challenge government secrecy and militarism, as long as you have this tremendous hypocrisy built into not only the partisan arena but the mass media, we're going to have the situation we have right now. I mean, Chelsea Manning is in prison right now after 7 years behind bars, but Chelsea's back in prison now because of a very principled stand to not testify before a grand jury against WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. How often do you see in the news media any reference to Chelsea Manning now? You don't see it. You don't hear it. How often have you seen an editorial or a column in the New York Times defending Manning? It just doesn't hardly ever happen. And this tells you how corrupted the corporate media are and how much work we have to do to change this entire situation.
If you can't say why I did it because this was going to happen, what is it they're looking for then when you can, if there is a case when you can do this?
What the prosecutors are looking for is the railroad to get you to prison and keep you in prison for quite a while. And that's really the kangaroo court aspect of the whole setup. When Snowden emerged from his whistleblowing, went public, not only did you have Secretary of State John Kerry calling him a traitor, you also had people like Kerry and someone who said he was not a traitor but still should be prosecuted, Nancy Pelosi at the time, they all, with a chorus of other government officials of both parties, they said, oh, Snowden should come back to the United States and face trial. What they really meant is they wanted him to come back and be railroaded into prison, be treated the way that Chelsea Manning was, put in solitary in conditions that a UN investigator said, conditions that were tantamount to torture through extreme deprivation, sensory deprivation, and isolation in solitary. There is no justice for those sorts of courageous whistleblowers who go outside channels to really provide the public with information that we need in a democracy.
What do you think is going to happen to this whistleblower?
My crystal ball is in the shop. I don't know. I think that on the one hand, you have a vicious administration run by a very megalomaniac nut named Donald Trump, being backed up by the vast majority of Republicans in Congress. And the Trump administration, of course, has control over the so-called Justice Department. So in that way, it's hazardous for this whistleblower. We're told is from the CIA. We don't know that for sure. Apparently, it is someone in the intelligence arena. I don't like the phrase intelligence community. We don't know how far the Trump regime will be able to push to vindictively punish that whistleblower. On the other hand, that whistleblower is a darling of most of the media, with Fox and the right-wing media accepted. So it's really hard to tell what will happen to that individual.
Norman Solomon is Executive Director of the Institute for Public Policy and National Coordinator of RootsAction.org. That's RootsAction.org. And finally, Jesse Norman, the American soprano who brought her sumptuous, shimmering voice to a broad range of roles at the Metropolitan Opera, died on Monday. She won 5 Grammy Awards, 4 for her recordings and 1 for lifetime achievement. Norman sang more than 80 performances at the Met. Its general manager, Peter Gelb, called her one of the greatest artists to ever sing on our stage. As an African American, she credited other great black singers with paving the way for her, naming Marian Anderson, Dorothy Maynard, and Leontine Price, among others. Norman was born into a musical family on September 15, 1945, in Augusta, Georgia, growing up there in a segregated but close-knit world. Her mother, Janie King Norman, was an amateur pianist. Her father, Silas Norman Sr., was an insurance broker. She began listening to opera on the radio as a child. Jesse Norman was 74. And that was Jesse Norman performing at the Capitol for the president at that time, President Bill Clinton. She won many, many great awards, including coveted awards presented by the White House. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, October 1st, 2019. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. I'm Paul DiRienzo.